You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Times Higher Education Issue Review podcast for the edition covering the 27th of August to the 2nd of September 2015. My name is Chris Parr. I'm joined by editor John Gill and reporters Chris Havergal and David Matthews. In the UK, the Higher Education Academy needs to rethink its business model following the removal of financial support from the funding councils. That's due to kick in from 2016-2017. The new chair is Rama Thirumanachandran. He's Vice Chancellor at Canterbury Christ Church and has been speaking to Chris Havergal about his plans for the organisation. More on that in just a second. Our front cover this week features 10 pictures of banana skins. Not just for fun, they illustrate this week's lead feature entitled 10 Steps to PhD Failure. John Gill's going to explain to us why he's put it on the front cover this week. And finally, David Matthews will be looking at a paper that investigates the impact that managerialism has had on universities, in particular on scholars' academic freedom. The findings might not be what you expect. And if we have time, we'll take a look at how Minecraft, that popular video game or world-building video game, I think I've seen it described, is working for one UK institution. But Chris, first, the Higher Education Academy, it's an organisation that champions university teaching. It's losing its funding from the UK funding councils. How will it survive?
You would think with the teaching excellence framework on the way that the HEA would be riding high, would be flush with cash and would be being supported by the funding councils. That's not the case. As you say, the funding council support has already been drastically slashed and is going to be down to zero by 2016-17. I've been speaking to Rama Thirumanachandran about the future of the organisation. He's got quite a clear vision for the direction in which it should go. He thinks it should become a professional body for academic staff and support staff who are involved in teaching and learning. That might help to give it a bit of a tighter focus. Perhaps some people would say that it tried to do too much in the past, but perhaps the most significant thing is that one thing that usually comes with being a professional body is the charging of individual subscription fees to individual members. The funding council supporters dropped off dramatically, as we say, and the amount of institutional subscription that the HEA has received hasn't really increased at anywhere near the similar sort of rate. So if they were able to persuade individual members, and currently they've got 65,000 fellows, if they were able to convert that into paying subscriptions, that could be a significant revenue source.
It's not going to be very popular, though, is it? I've written about teachers in the past. I used to work for a nursing magazine. They have to pay subs to their professional bodies, the GTC and the Nursing and Midwifery Council. In those incidents, it's not very popular when those fees are even raised marginally. Never mind introduced out of nothing.
Indeed, and especially when it could be argued that many of the things that the HEA might argue, things around sort of continuing professional development, etc., could already be got for free elsewhere, either from institutions or indeed from professional bodies linked to disciplines which academics are already members of. Most academics would perhaps get their professional identity from their discipline, be it sort of engineering, their geography, whatever, and membership therefore of the relevant professional association. I think the key thing here is, coming back to the TEF, which I mentioned at the start of this, if the holding of fellowships, for example, is a key measure which is going to be measured in the TEF, if then consequently holding of such a fellowship could be linked in some way to subscriptions, i.e. you had to pay a subscription to be a fellow, that could give the HEA quite strong leverage and put it in a strong position.
And also, if I think, you know, one of the things that we've seen over recent years start to appear, although not perhaps across the board, is teaching and teaching qualifications being taken into account in promotion criteria. And at that point, suddenly it becomes a much more pressing concern for the individual if they think that, you know, this is a route to a higher salary and higher grades and so on. Whether in the end it's still the individual that should be putting their hand in their pocket rather than their employer, I think is open to question.
I'd question as well whether maybe the Oxfords and the Cambridges of this world, would they be sort of looking to the HEA to rubber stamp their teaching staff, or would they think they can do it themselves, that they know more about teaching anyway, they know what kind of teachers they want, and if they don't get on board, would that not undermine it?
It's a good case. I mean, someone like Rama, who I spoke to for this piece, would say that there is so much change in sort of technology that we use in teaching and learning, in sort of different methods and ideas about pedagogy, that it would be wrong for anyone to say, you know, I don't need to engage with this sort of thing, I don't need to take part in CPD or anything sort of accredited by the HEA. I think what it reflects is a lot of the sort of horse trading that's perhaps taking place behind the scenes about organisations which are going to be sort of recognised as expert bodies for the TEF process, you know, that are going to be part of the stuff that's going to form the criteria. If the HEA can persuade the government that it should be part of that, you know, Oxford and Cambridge might not have a great deal of choice, especially if the TEF, you know, could result in increased tuition fees.
Indeed. Well, page 6 and 7 in the magazine for that news story. Chris has also written a blog offering a little bit more insight. You'll find that on the blog section of the website. It's also down in the news story as well in the magazine. Moving on, the front cover, John, this week features, as I said at the top of the show, a lot of banana skins. PhD features always attract enormous attention online. This one's called 10 Surefire Ways to Fail Your PhD. It seems a little bit counterintuitive. Why have we popped this on the front cover, and why do you think such features do so well?
You're very fond of the front cover of 10 Banana Skins, aren't you? I think it's been mentioned 3 or 4 times. Question is...
I was privy to the conversations about making the front cover. I know it went through a number of incarnations.
Well, is it 10 Banana Skins, or is it the same banana skin photographed 10 times? That's the question. This is, I mean, we have huge amounts of interest, we know, in anything we write about PhDs. I suppose the simple fact is there are an awful lot of people coming through PhDs, you know, looking to sort of make their first steps in academic life at any given time. And we also know, of course, that PhD students tend to be quite isolated from one another. There are an awful lot of them, but they don't necessarily spend an awful lot of time in each other's company. And what we've really learned over the years covering this topic is that a lot of the issues that crop up during your PhD are widely shared. But people sort of are having to reinvent the wheel the whole time as they deal with them. So these kind of advice pieces have proved wildly popular in the past, and this one's likely to as well. Just to give you the background, this is a sort of summary of 10 of the most interesting points made in a new book, a forthcoming book called 57 Ways to Screw Up in Grad School by a couple of
57 varieties
professors in North America. Yeah, and really we've picked out 10 of those that we think are sort of the most interesting lessons, and they're kind of, you know, things we've touched on before. For example, one of the ways you can fail your PhD is by choosing the coolest supervisor, these professors say. And it's a fun way of saying that actually for your choice of supervisor is incredibly important. And the tendency may be to try and track down some superstar that, you know, you think is going to be incredibly charismatic and sort of, you know, sexy supervisor. I say that in not in the way that you're all thinking, but actually,
although 10 on the list, number is actually 10. Do not get romantically involved with your supervisor. But I realise that's a different.
Do get romantically involved if you want to fail your PhD, exactly. But I think this supervisor and supervisee relationship is something that we come back to time and time again, because it's really at the heart of a successful PhD. And interestingly, it does, I mean, part of the point of choosing the coolest supervisor is they may well be somebody that isn't going to give the time and energy and attention that you need to have somebody kind of, you know, really help you work your way from being essentially a student into an early career academic. And one of the things that this feature also ties in with actually is another piece we had this week about the problem of PhD students being having their work inappropriately appropriated by their supervisors in terms of co-authorship on papers where the PhD student perhaps has done huge amounts of the work and the supervisor steps in the last minute and says, well, I'll take a credit for that. It's something that Tara Brabazon, who's written for us in the past on this, is Tara's Professor of Education at Charles Sturt University in Australia, calls byline banditry. This is where, you know, a supervisor doesn't have the best interests of their PhD student at heart. So that's just one of the topics that this touches on. But 10 tips there, and I'd strongly recommend that anyone thinking of doing a PhD gives it a read.
Yeah, absolutely. That's on page 30 in this week's magazine, and of course is online as well. Now, we've got a story just online today. It's about Alice Drager, who's a bioethicist, or was, at the University, at Northwestern University in the US. She's resigned her professorship after administrators censored her work. That brings me nicely to a story, David, that you've written this week about increasing number of managers in institutions, generally seen as a bad thing by scholars, but you've been looking at a paper that suggests maybe not so bad.
Yes, I mean, in universities amongst academics, there is a sort of generalised feeling that they've lost control of universities and this is a bad thing. It's now all run by managers, you know. And in some sort of golden era previously, they all kind of got together in committees and decided how things were going to be run, how budgets were going to be spent. But this has been crushed by, you know, bad managers. But there's a paper that's recently come out from Giulio Mariani, who's a postdoc at the Centre for Research in Higher Education Policies in Portugal, who basically looked at data from 26 universities all across Europe. And it found that actually those universities that had the higher reported levels of managerialism, like high control by managers, actually also had lots of collegiality, basically. You know, they were democratically controlled, they were kind of veto power by academics and so forth, and things were decided together. He's saying, you know, academics shouldn't see these things as necessarily conflicting. So if you have managers who say, right, this is the aim of what the university needs to get done, then you can still have a lot of internal democracy and a lot of autonomy over how you achieve those aims. So, you know, he's saying managers can't tell you how to teach well and how to do good research, but you do need someone there setting these goals. And his point was that in the sort of early 2000s, late 90s, there was a lot of research, there was a lot of concern about how these two things would conflict and whether this, you know, the advent of managers in universities was the, you know, a kind of waning of something that was really valuable. But actually he was saying that, you know, now that has kind of subsided, and maybe academics should, you know, reconcile themselves to this, you know, a manager-led university.
There's a difference though, isn't there, between management, and I suppose I mean good management by that, and managerialism, which is this sort of nasty morass that sort of takes over and seeps through and clogs everything up. I mean, isn't that a key difference?
Yeah, he really said that, you know, good managers can engender trust, but it can also destroy trust really, you know, very rapidly. You can end up loathing those managers. And also, you know, these two things existing together. I mean, one of the reasons why it might be, you might have lots of collegiality amongst academics who, you know, feel like they're working together, but they're working together against the management. There's nothing that kind of unites academics more than these kind of bureaucratic controls, and they you know trying to sort of subvert them and push back against them.
Mm.
And there's also an interesting point made also in the article by David Palfreyman at the Centre for Higher Education at Oxford. He's saying, well, basically almost all universities in the world are now basically run by managers. I mean, they're, you know, run that line, except for the sort of the top 50 research ones, you know, in the UK, Oxford, Cambridge, where the academics do still have quite a lot of power of the institution, effectively.
Mm.
Because if you didn't give them that, if you didn't give them that autonomy, they just leave. So we've got this kind of two-tier system. You've got the kind of premiership of universities, where as an academic you are still in charge of the ship, whereas everything else is now basically managerial.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting stuff. Well, page 13 for that story. Before we go, quickly, Chris, I mentioned you've been looking at Minecraft and how that might be making its way into the university sector, the University of Hull specifically.
Yeah, that's right. It's actually been schools that have led the way on the use of Minecraft in education. Anyone who doesn't know what Minecraft is, I think the technical term might be a sandbox world-building computer game. But basically,
well, that'll clear it up for me. That'll really...
But it's, I must say, it's not something I've played myself. But the way that they've used it at Hull, one of the sort of pioneers of Minecraft's use in higher education, they've done things like recreating the site of a deserted medieval village, encouraging students to excavate the site in Minecraft and then to sort of build a replica of what they think would have been there. They've also used it for public engagement projects, inviting the public to build from designs by a 20th century architect, and there's even been some sports physiology students who've used it to run around inside the game. It's a good question why they couldn't do it in real life, but they've used Minecraft to calculate how much energy is burned by certain tasks. Joel Mills, who is Hull's Technology Enhanced Learning Advisor, describes using Minecraft in higher education as being like feeding children chocolate-covered broccoli. In that, you know, it's
disgusting. That's not nice at all.
What he means by that is where there are sort of issues or tasks or conceptualising of things which may be particularly challenging, this could be an accessible and innovative way to go about it.
Can we have a front cover next week with 10 pieces of chocolate-covered broccoli on? I've got one question, Chris. This follows hot on the heels of a story you wrote about using Candy Crush as a model for teaching and learning.
Yes.
So my question is, what can we learn from Sonic the Hedgehog?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, I must say, a good question of how many students at university at the moment actually know who Sonic the Hedgehog
is.
That's true.
Yeah, showing my age there.
I think
they could study history with Sonic the Hedgehog. John, I think that's the upshot. They could study the deep, dark depths of history. And that's all for this week's THE Issue Review podcast. Just to remind you, the Best University Workplace Survey 2016, where we want your views if you work in the UK on your university, is open now. If you go to the homepage, you'll see an advert there. Please do take part. Until then, if you want to comment on anything we've discussed or anything in the magazine more widely, you can do so at that website or on Twitter, on Facebook, on LinkedIn and on Google+. Just search for us on all of those platforms. But until next week, that's all for the THE Issue Review podcast.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.